From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
Brooke Gladstone is on vacation. I'm Mike Pesca. The kidnapping of a child is the prototypical parental nightmare, and thus riveting story material. Yet, though there are between 200 and 300 such cases each year in the United States, few attract the media's undivided attention, such as occurred this week in the Utah abduction of 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart. Here is MSNBC's Ashley Banfield on location in the search team's map room.
Mapping is a crucial part of this. Every single area that they decide upon will be searched, and at times will be searched twice as well.
From the moment Elizabeth was reported kidnapped, the media, especially cable news, massed in Salt Lake City. And that suits Ben Ermini, director of Missing Children for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He joins us. Ben, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
What is it about Elizabeth Smart's apparent abduction that has captured the attention of the media?
Well, I think probably the circumstances surrounding the child's abduction. The child was abducted from her bedroom by an abductor who came into the house and abducted her at gunpoint, and the fact that there was another child's sister in the room along with them. And probably because of the fact that the child was abducted from an affluent neighborhood. And so this is the type of case that the media would become interested in.
Well, obviously, notwithstanding the fact that they're living through a nightmare, from a publicity point of view, the Smart family has more or less hit the jackpot, have they not?
Well, I think they have. I think that they're getting a lot of attention, and I think that's important. I mean, if you look at the Chandra Levy case, that case got a tremendous amount of media attention, and it got the media attention because there was a congressman involved in that particular case.
Chandra Levy is probably the apotheosis of the gross, out-of-proportion attention to a single missing person. Do you ever, in your position, even in your position, wince when one case is so disproportionately covered by the media to the exclusion of others?
Yes, we had a case down in Houston, Laura Ayala case, the young girl who was sent out by her mom to pick up a newspaper at a local gas station, and the child never returned. And we tried to get as much coverage as we could for the child, and for some reason it wasn't getting a lot of coverage.
Now, Laura was Hispanic?
She was Hispanic, yes.
Rich or poor?
I would say she probably comes from a poorer class family.
I guess I may as well not be coy about asking you this. Do you think if Laura Ayala were rich and white, that the national cable channels would have been on the Ayala doorstep, camped out there for the duration?
I don't know what the motivation of the media is.
But what I'm asking you is, do you get frustrated when these, say, less inviting cases of tragedy don't get picked up by the media?
We have 5,200 active cases in our database. I'd like to see a lot more of those cases getting national attention. And I certainly don't think that we shouldn't be providing the national attention to the Elizabeth Smart case, because I think the child is in danger. I think it's important that we do it. I wish we could do it in more cases.
But if you gave every case the Elizabeth Smart treatment, and you say you have 5,200 active cases in your files, there would have to be a missing children channel, wouldn't there?
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I would certainly encourage that type of a channel.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Ermini of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. What would distinguish a missing child channel is the convergence of the media's interests and those of the victim's family.
We do want to give you a 1-800 number, because no matter where you are across America, there is that chance you might see this blonde, beautiful little 5'6", 105-pound girl.
Joining me now is Roy Peter Clark, senior scholar for the Poynter Institute. In child abduction cases, Clark says, audiences are confronted with the public agony of desperate people whose need for help trumps any wish for privacy.
The discomfort of watching people in agony up close. In the case of missing children, it's one of the only times that people put themselves in that circumstance intentionally. Most of the other cases of public grieving that we know about the press is pictured and sometimes caricatured as predatory and intrusive. When I see the parents start to cry and I see the camera perspective move closer and closer, I actually have been known to pick up the clicker and surf over to ESPN.
Well, I guess that's the question then. When the exploitation in a story like this is happening with the express complicity of the exploited parties, isn't there some special responsibility for the media to consider its actions and to behave with some modicum of sensitivity? Or is it just, you know, we've got a free pass here, let's just wring out every molecule of emotion that we can?
If I were an editor, if I were a news director, there's one question that I'd have to answer, and that would be, what's the journalistic purpose of this story? If I can defend some larger, more important social purpose, then the decision to give extraordinary coverage to a particular story will be easier.
So in a case like this, in which you can easily rationalize the social purpose by helping the parents and helping the police, is there some threshold of the number of hours of saturation coverage before you've kind of expended the capital that social purpose has endowed you with, and you have just moved over into the realm of gross exploitation and pandering to viewers' say basest instincts?
One of the great historical precedents for us is going to be the Chandra Levy case, and the way in which that case fell off the radar screen, even as it dominated our attention. But September 11th comes along, one of the great news stories, and one of the effects of that was to just show the shallowness of that particular story. I think that's a moral lesson that a lot of journalists can long remember.
Roy Peter Clark is a senior scholar at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Each day that the news out of the Middle East is about violence and strife and grief, more interest groups in America state their cases to the media about who they support and why. One coalition firmly supporting Israel has surprised many people for its seemingly odd combination, an alliance between Jews and evangelical Christians. It turns out that the relationship is an old one, with roots in the Bible, but it's also one that has caught the media short as journalists and pundits try to place it in context, ideological, historical, and theological. Well, some of the theological. For instance, NPR's Mara Liasson reported recently that Christians recognize the status of Jews as God's chosen people, and a report last week in the New York Times said simply that evangelicals were driven by a mixture of biblical prophecy and ideology. But what those reports didn't mention is any explanation of what prophecy is exactly. Gustav Niebuhr was the national religion reporter for the New York Times from 1994 through 2001 and is now a visiting fellow for the Center of the Study of Religion at Princeton University. He says that the current practice of explaining the theological underpinnings of evangelical beliefs by simply writing the word prophecy is a dodge.
It's a shorthand that I don't think tells you very much unless you're aware of this popular interest in what's called Bible prophecy, and that is how you can read certain texts in the Bible as a way of looking into the future.
People who read the Bible, who believe in Genesis, who believe in Matthew, also have to believe in Revelation.
Janet Parshall, who spoke at a large pro-Israel rally in Washington in April, hosts a Christian radio program heard on more than 100 stations.
Revelation says declaratively, oh, you bet Israel is going to be the place. Which, by the way, is another reason why I think my audience sits up and takes notice on this issue, because no one knows exactly when it's going to end, but we do know where it's going to end.
The end that she's talking about is the end of the world, the second coming of Christ, also known as the end times. There are many different interpretations as to when this will happen and how, but that it will happen is a given in evangelical faiths. And for the end to come, Israel must be inhabited by Jews. Albert Moeller, president of the Southern Baptist Seminary, discussed biblical prophecy on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer.
We will see, as the New Testament tells us, a vast turning to Jesus Christ, to Christianity, to the gospel on the part of Jewish people. And then there are specific New Testament prophecies related to Jerusalem and to the coming reign of the Lord Jesus Christ. There is a clear consensus of support for Israel and the understanding that God is not finished with the Jewish people.
Southern Baptists make up the second largest religious denomination in America after Roman Catholics. A recent AP poll revealed that 40% of Christians thought that Jesus would return in the 21st century. That may account for why the best-selling book of last year was another in the Left Behind series of novels, a take on the Second Coming set in the near future, which many faithful regard as the truth. In those books, which have sold a total of 50 million copies, the conversion of Jews is essential to the return of Christ. But that's a message that leaders like former Christian Coalition Chairman Ralph Reed are careful to de-emphasize, as happened in the face of this grilling from Hardball host Chris Matthews.
Isn't there a religious reason why your groups, the evangelical Christians, want to have Israel reestablished as it has been revived since 1948 so that the second coming can occur and you can have the apocalypse, the end of the world, and the general judgment? Isn't that a religious conviction of the evangelicals that some people adhere to, and that's why they support the state of Israel as it is?
I will tell you that I think the notion that this is based on eschatology or it's based on a particular view of the end times is really hogwash. I don't find
well, I'm
that
glad to hear you say that. Let me ask you.
Journalist Gustav Niebuhr says that, unlike Matthews, most members of the media don't take a rooting interest in the Second Coming. They just don't understand how pervasive the belief is among many religious Americans. He also thinks that to fully engage the issue takes reporters down a path they're often reluctant to travel.
If you talk about evangelicals and Jews forging some kind of alliance, then it raises the question of, well, how's this going to play out in the next election? If you bring in the theology, you're talking about something else, and the reaction to it is going to be considerably different. It's going to be, well, you're talking about people's beliefs. Some people are going to agree, some people are going to disagree. But I think that makes it less accessible, less fitting within the standard news paradigm.
And less revealing of the real story. Niebuhr's point is that reporters would rather look at historical facts and political motivations and come up with a fairly simple way of describing the partnership. But it's more than facts and motivations that reverberate from the pulpits of evangelical churches. It's often word of the Second Coming or end times, concepts journalists usually ignore. And because of that, the media's explanations come off as something less than gospel.
Coming up, now that Brooke is safely out of earshot, the first of three sports-related segments, and Chris Lydon goes to Ghana.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Bob Garfield, beginning with this brief digression. The movie Fatal Attraction is a gripping thriller about a married man whose brief affair turns ugly when his lover begins to terrorize his family. Unfaithful men everywhere shuddered when seeing their worst nightmare depicted by Michael Douglas and Glenn Close on the big screen. Well, that's approximately the way I reacted when I heard about Dennis Horgan Jr. Horgan was a senior producer at ESPN Radio until the network searched through some of its employees' old emails and fired him and three of his pals for exchanging messages with vulgar content. The news sent a shiver down my spine, as it may be sending shivers down yours at this very moment. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. All right, tell me what happened.
There had been a previous incident about a week earlier where a fairly high-profile person at ESPN had been let go for unrelated company policy. Apparently, when they went through that person's email after, anyone that had ever sent him an email where there was any sort of inappropriate content, they then went into those people's files. And anyone that had sent that person's email account anything inappropriate, they then went into that person's files. So sort of like a spider web that just sort of expanded into a group of probably 10 to 15 different people.
And what was their methodology? Were there certain words and phrases? Is that how it works?
I'm not sure what they went in looking for. What they found was conversations back and forth between male colleagues. Inappropriate language may have been used that printed out on an email and a piece of paper sitting on a desk in front of all your bosses looks fairly inappropriate. But
so this was not broadcast. This was not anything that the public ever saw. A communications company firing employees for communicating.
That's the great fear here, is that email has become such a second language to everybody that I think we all take for granted the fact that you can zip back and forth emails and it's as if you're standing across a room talking to each other. You know, no matter how much you're warned about it or told about it, you'd never think that somebody was up there looking down, watching it all. And there had been no complaints from anybody. No one was harassing any other employees. These were conversations between friends, much like took place everywhere else in the company, just not on the company's email.
Well, in fact, on the company's air, because ESPN's brand image, if you will, is a kind of irreverence and a winking acknowledgement that boys will be boys.
Right. The recent Bobby Knight movie, there was graphic language that they promoted like crazy, and you know, they have a new comedy show that sort of prides itself on going lowbrow, not to mention, you know, a lot of the stuff in the magazine that comes out.
Well, now that you are a martyr to guy talk, what are you going to do?
I'm going to look for work.
When they told you that you were fired, did you swear?
I have relived that meeting 1,000 times, and I have all sorts of fantasies about what I should have done and what I should have said. And most of it involved picking up the email and saying, come on, this is funny. What are you talking about? Look at it. It's funny. But I didn't do any of that.
You forgot to swear.
I forgot to swear. Oh, well, hopefully I'll see him on the street. I'll swear at him then.
No. Dennis Horgan, thank you very much.
No problem.
Dennis Horgan Jr. was the senior producer for the Tony Kornheiser Show on ESPN Radio. Officials at ESPN declined to come on our show. They told us Mr. Horgan was fired for violation of the company's email policy. To the remote Himalayan nation of Bhutan. Tucked inside the mountains between Tibet and India, speaking its native tongue Dzongkha, fiercely protective of its traditional Buddhist society, Bhutan has survived independently for thousands of years with little help from the outside world. But even all the Bhutanese king's men can't stop the forces of digitization and globalization forever. And in 1999, Bhutan became the last nation in the world to get cable TV, HBO, the Cartoon Network, the BBC, and the World Wrestling Federation.
The Rock has come back to Las Vegas!
East Asian scholar Orville Schell took one of the rare flights into Bhutan to see what 26 channels of cable and pro wrestling had done to this Buddhist fiefdom.
kids around the country began acting out roles as if they too were professional wrestlers, cutting cardboard, you know, belts and all the affectations of this utterly bizarre Western world. It really stunned people, and people began to wonder, what have we done? I mean, why have we let all this in? And one of the most sort of notable effects was that there was much less street life. People used to sit outside their houses and talk, and suddenly everybody was inside watching television. It's very seductive stuff, and there's no way that, you know, a traditional dance at the local Buddhist monastery is going to be able to compete with 26 channels of lurid cable replete with all of the bombastic commercial advertising that goes with it.
Well, if cultural imperialism is a general problem, this must be a most acute case of it. Is the society damaged in any visible ways?
Well, you know, I don't think it's more acute, the actual effects on Bhutan, than on any other place in the world. It was simply that this needle went into the arm of Bhutan in such a high-speed way. A country that, you know, has a king. King has four queens. They're all sisters. There's been a tradition of relatively benevolent rule. And one of the operating principles of this small little Buddhist kingdom is a thing called gross national happiness, not gross national product. And the idea being that the measure of what a country and a government does and is should be the happiness of its people, not simply their economic well-being. Well, cable television, I suppose you could say it, does increase gross national happiness if your idea is to be a couch potato. But on the other hand, this society, which had tried to shepherd itself and protect the virtues and the values of its traditional culture and religion, suddenly found itself upended in the most violent fashion by this intrusion, which it could have controlled, but alas, isn't really controlling.
Well, what if the government ministers and the Buddhist clergy had to say about this sudden infusion of Western low culture?
Well, I think most people are rather confused and even depressed by what they're seeing. Even people who are involved in owning, running, and profiting from the cable systems that are being set up. I think the government made a major mistake here, and I think most people recognize it. The question is, how do you get the genie back in the bottle?
So if the culture shock of cable television wasn't enough, about a year later, along comes the internet. Are Tsongkha speaking prepubescents dialing up teensluts.com?
Well, it's interesting in the case of the internet, this was controlled in a way which was somewhat more thoughtful. The government became an internet service provider, but they also had the wisdom to sort of filter it with a backstop program, which did filter out at least a large measure of the pornographic websites that young people could dial up. And I think in many ways, you know, the internet, it's not such a danger to Bhutan, because one can make the argument that, unlike television, it's much less invasive and intrusive, and indeed is a way, provides a way for a little country that wants to keep a certain distance to be connected, to be involved, and to have transactions going on, but not be physically invaded.
Well, I guess this all leads to one question, and that is the following. The Bhutanese, are they liking the Osbournes?
Well, you know, you walk down the street of the capital of Thimphu in Bhutan, and you look through the doorways and you see all these people spaced out in front of, you know, their television screens. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, is this a good thing? I mean, it raises that very Monty Python-ish question of the meaning of life. Why are we here? Are we here to recite sutras in the local monastery or temple, or are we here to watch the World Wrestling Federation? I don't quite know how to answer that. I like to watch a little television myself, and I'd be the last one to deny the Bhutanese that privilege. But I do think you know, if you believe at all that there's equilibriums that need to be maintained in a good life, Bhutan is one of the last places that has a chance to sort of engineer that equilibrium in an intelligent way. And I'm not sure, you know, all of these cable channels being lofted over the mountains and into these once sylvan, quiet, peaceful valleys is the way to affect it. On the other hand, I believe in free speech. How can you prevent people from watching what they want to watch? It's a very interesting and tricky question to answer with absolute certainty.
Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Orville Schell is a professor and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley.
One person's fear is another's opportunity. While the Bhutanese worry that Western media and technology may overwhelm their traditional culture, officials in parts of Africa are trying to use the internet to fuel their economies and keep Africans from leaving to work elsewhere. That's what talk show host and journalist Christopher Lydon found when he traveled to West Africa and took to the airwaves.
102.3 FM. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the program we call Wide World on broadcast radio in Ghana.
Earlier this spring, I hosted a call-in talk show for 2 weeks in Ghana. The mission was not so much to try out an American radio format on Africans as it was to listen to the talk of Accra, Ghana's capital. It turns out a lot of people were talking about what we talk about, the internet.
Caller, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good evening. The name is Fando. I think the internet's a powerful tool. We're not making the best use of it.
John Perry Barlow, lyricist for the Grateful Dead and now a cyber philosopher, was one of our radio guests in Ghana. Barlow was a Montana rancher who moved into high tech without ever passing through a factory job or office work.
At best, the internet can help Africa skip the industrial period. The industrial period is about turning human beings into interchangeable machine parts. I mean, you come to Africa and you see still a sense of human connection that is almost entirely missing from the Northern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. My desire was not to wire Africa so that the money could flow downstream, but so that heartfulness and connection might flow upstream.
There are cyber cafes up and down the ring road known as Silicon Alley in Accra. At the biggest and brightest cyber hive of them all, known as Busy Internet, I watched the focused faces of mostly young Ghanaians staring at 100 computer screens around the clock for many familiar reasons.
Everything you want is on the internet. When you want to know the weather of different countries, you can see. You want to hear more news, you want to know what is happening now. In other countries at the moment, you can see all that on the internet.
So far, I've been able to correspond with a friend at South Africa. And I have another friend too in Britain too. His name is called Greg. It is my dream one day to maybe meet them.
My name is Gladys, and I come to browse about 4 times in a week. Sometimes to go to the singles. It's exciting to chat online, you know. You don't know the person. It's very exciting, you know.
I mean, you can't imagine it. When we were starting Busy Internet, we did not even imagine that this is how it was going to be like, you know. The traffic, the human traffic. I mean, it's almost full almost every time. And we understand because we understand there is no place like this on the continent of Africa.
Historically, outside technologies like the train, the telephone, and Western weaponry all served the colonizing powers better than they served Africans overall. So you have to ask yourself, is this another northern trick being played on the Africans? How different will the internet be? Herman Chinnery Hess runs the biggest little software company in Ghana.
I'm Ghanaian and I grew up in Ghana. Now, there are certain fundamental problems that the internet access addresses. Basically, it kind of bridges the gap. And it basically puts Ghana in touch with the world.
It sounds a little bit like pre-bubble internet hype in America a few years ago, but it's a shiny new bubble from the African angle.
If we educate fantastic architects in Ghana, They can take Chinese government contracts and do them over the net and win the contracts internationally because the internet doesn't know color, it doesn't know race, it doesn't know country of origin, it doesn't know, you see what I mean? Suddenly, boom, clean slate. We can participate any way we like.
There is a darker side of the internet dream in Africa. Already there are cyber sweatshops in Ghana processing New York City parking tickets and doing other humble data processing jobs at very low wages. Another point, the internet for some users here is not about jobs in Ghana. It's an escape route to the West. A lot of those email messages we saw at the busy internet cyber cafe were really a sort of SOS, get me out of here. But here's the question that was tossed back at me. For a Ghanaian on the way to England, say, who might take a job watching TV security monitors on a London parking lot, wouldn't it be a better deal to stay in Ghana and monitor the same parking lots through a web connection? Herman Chinnery Hess.
I've met very few Ghanaians who actually enjoy living abroad. They want to live in Ghana. I mean, as long as they could sit in Ghana and work and earn a decent wage, they won't go. Rather than go to the West, they'll go to their village and provide their services online. This can happen with psychologists, doctors, anybody you can think of, unless there's a physical contact required.
Chinnery Hess would love to see internet villages in Ghana doing the complex work of the world or selling goods that aren't available elsewhere.
I'll tell you what I imagine the future of the internet is. Some small village community have a bunch of mango trees and they plant a particular kind of special mango which only grows in this part of that village, let's say. And now the whole village makes $1,000 a year. They now have some group in Japan who love these mangoes because they use them to eat with sushi or something. And so they buy $10,000 of mangoes every month.
It's a long road from cyber cafes to widespread cyber employment. Phones are still few in Ghana. About 1 in 100 Ghanaians has one. Phone bills are high. Web access is shaky at times. But finally, it was a young man, Edwin Beta, on the staff at Busy Internet, who persuaded me that there's more than technology at work here. Edwin Beta sent me an essay he had written called Shaping the Future. It's the internet that wires up Edwin Beta's vision. More than any preceding generation, he wrote, we can exercise control over how we use our time and energy. Shaping our future depends on the choices we make. We must practice giving ourselves the things that sustain us. It is God's will that we live abundantly. What we have is the universe's gift to us. What we become is our gift to the universe. As I read Edwin Beta's essay, I couldn't imagine an African of a century ago laying track for railroad barons like Cecil Rhodes, taking the same inspiration from an imported technology. For On the Media, I'm Christopher Lydon.
Coming up, the NBA won't give up the funk, and why in Russia TV watches you?
That was Mike Yakov-Smirnov impression. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Mike Pesca. A couple of weeks ago, Vladimir Putin received the news that the U.S. Department of Commerce had recognized Russia as a market economy. That status is a crucial condition for Russia's admission into the World Trade Organization, which sets the ground rules for international trade. But while Russia heads towards a future of free trade, the marketplace of free ideas suffered yet another blow.
A former KGB official named Alexander Zdanovich was given one of the top posts at the state-owned RTR television network, Russia's largest, with an audience of more than 100 million people. Zdanovich's position grants him oversight of all content, including coverage of upcoming parliamentary elections. Masha Lipman is the deputy editor of a weekly magazine called Journal. The magazine she used to write for was shut down by the government. She says this personnel move was an intimidation ploy, and don't be fooled that they don't call it the KGB anymore.
We call it FSB, and of course it's no longer the omnipotent monster, the intimidating body controlling every step and imposing government control over every person in the country. However, Alexander Zdanovich himself, as top spokesman of FSB, the KGB successor, has never concealed his feelings about free press. For instance, he said FSB will fight everything that threatens Russia's interests, including in the world of the media. He likened to terrorists those reporters who dared cover the Chechen war not the way that pleased the government. He said that the interests of the public are identical to the interests of the state, a statement that, to me, smells of Soviet propaganda.
Well, I would say it was a case of the fox guarding the hen house, except that RTR wasn't exactly the brave voice of independent journalism to begin with. It's state-run, state-owned, and has been, shall we say, very friendly towards the Putin government. Why would RTR need this kind of hardliner?
Actually, I don't have an answer to this question. I don't think there is a need for a hardliner because the channel is perfectly loyal to the government as it is. This does not mean that every word is censored. Far from it. This just means that sensitive subjects are covered in the quote-unquote right way, the way it suits the Kremlin. To me, this appointment is all the more outrageous because there is no government need for this.
The last 2 years have been very difficult for independent media in Russia, particularly independent television. How has RTR fared during this period? Does it have any credibility left with the Russian people? Are they buying the government line?
Yes, I would say the simple answer is yes. A very small minority of the public cares about free press, about press being not controlled by the state. And today we do not have a single national TV channel that is fully uncontrolled. When the government took over the privately owned national TV channel NTV about a year ago, only about 4% of the Russian public thought this was infringing on the freedom of the press. Unfortunately, the public is all for more government control today.
Let me ask you one more thing. In covering what you cover for Journal, are you looking over your shoulder at the government and the security apparatus to make sure that you don't run afoul of them, or are you left alone to do what you do?
For the time being, we are fully left alone, I'm happy to say. Nobody interferes with our coverage. However, the Kremlin of today, when it wants to crack down on the press, uses more sophisticated ways than send its security people and interfere with your coverage. There is a whole variety of fairly sophisticated methods that stop short of interfering directly.
Well, for example?
You can always squelch a medium using business disputes, and this was what happened to NTV, the privately owned television channel. The government took advantage of the debts that the previous owner had. What I mean is, if the Kremlin is after you, he has a whole range of methods that would not look, at least on the surface, as harassing reporters or editors, as imposing censorship.
I understand. Well, I hope that soon you will not be so small and marginal as to be off of Putin's radar.
Well, I would hope so, too.
Masha Lipman, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Masha Lipman is deputy editor of the newsweekly Journal and a monthly columnist for The Washington Post.
In 1970, Major League pitcher Jim Boughton's memoir, Ball 4, sparked a controversy in the baseball world. Never before had so much been revealed about the unseemly side of America's pastime. Baseball's heroes, it turned out, could also be drunks, bigots, and degenerates. Now, big league slugger Jose Canseco says that you can add cheaters to that list. In a tell-all book, Canseco plans to detail the rampant use of illegal performance-enhancing steroids throughout baseball, naming names, including his own. In a recent Sports Illustrated article, another former MVP admitted to using steroids, estimating that half the league was using two. With the floodgates on a once-taboo subject open, baseball now faces a new threat to its image, much like the period following the release of Ball 4. Its author, Jim Bouton, joins us now. Jim, welcome to OTM.
Nice to be here.
Do I owe you an apology comparing your authorial talents with the presumed literary skills of Jose Canseco?
I haven't seen anything he's written so far, but it sounds like he's got an uphill battle considering that he's being scooped every day by the daily newspapers.
That's true. But do you think in his book, does Canseco deserve any credit if people don't come forward? The steroid issue, for one, may never change. And so, okay, he's looking to get one last big payday out of it. But isn't it better than silence on the issue?
He may already have achieved what you're talking about if the idea is to expose the fact that there's steroid use in the big leagues so that the Players Association and the owners ban it. He's probably already done that. It sounds like it may be a magazine article. It certainly doesn't sound like a book's worth.
Let's talk for a moment about the sports media's role in all of this. In 1970, any number of beat writers could have written what they saw with their own eyes, beating you to many of your punches. And today, it was a writer who did break the first big story. That's Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated. But really, the Red Sox fans were chanting to Jose Canseco, steroids, steroids, back in 1988, and it's not like no one knew about this.
You know, in my day, the few little truths that I told about baseball were shocking back then only because sports writers were not really writing about those kinds of things. It was mostly scores and promos for the team. A lot of writers considered themselves extensions of the team's public relations department. But since that time, maybe partly because of Ball 4, writers have felt the need to take a closer look at players as human beings. And so they're doing the job they weren't doing years ago, which is why Jose Canseco's book won't be shocking to anyone. A lot of times these things are shocking to the media because, they need a story.
So, right, but you can't deny that Verducci actually getting a former MVP, Ken Caminiti, on the record and admitting that he did it moved the story from the realm of rumor to the realm of confirmed fact.
That's true.
And I noticed that he is a writer who covers the sport itself. He doesn't travel with one team. And I think that that's not a coincidence.
I think you find that true not only in sports, but in politics, that
right.
The writers who normally cover it on a regular beat basis are the ones who end up deciding that maybe certain things shouldn't be written about. This was one of the things that David Halberstam talked about in the reporting on the Vietnam War. It was not the daily writers that covered the atrocities of My Lai, for example. It was Seymour Hersh, a writer who was covering it from a magazine point of view, and he wasn't one of the daily writers. But I do think it helps to have somebody from the outside coming in, which may be a good rationale for rotating writers so that they don't get too chummy with the people they're covering and they are able to have a better perspective.
All right, so I guess the last question is, you've never faced Canseco. How do you think you'd pitch him?
Early in my career, I would have changed speeds on him, thrown fastballs and changeup. Late in my career, I would have just thrown him the knuckleball right down the middle. The big hitters usually had trouble with a knuckleball.
Jim Bouton, thank you very much.
All right.
Jim Bouton is the author of Ball 4, the best-selling sports memoir of all time. His new book, Wakona Park, will be out this spring.
The NBA season ended this week after what's now become a typically drama-free finals, culminating in a L.A. Laker championship. It's the third straight season, which ended with the Lakers as champs, and television ratings were the lowest in years. But don't let that obscure the overall strides the NBA made this year. Through the regular season and through the playoffs up until the finals, TV ratings actually increased for the first time since Michael Jordan retired from the Chicago Bulls. A big reason is that the league has hit on a marketing strategy that celebrates what once was seen as the league's biggest liability. Leon Winter reports on why basketball is bringing back the funk.
In L.A., there's not a lot to say.
In New Jersey this week, National Basketball Association Commissioner David Stern addressed the press.
The entire playoffs have been sort of a good coming together for us.
Meanwhile, in another part of the hoop universe, the coach of the Roswell Rayguns was also taking media questions. Unlike Stern's corporate blue suit, he wore a loud plaid sports jacket that hasn't been seen since the Carter administration.
Coach, you were 5-79 last year. Why the playoff talk?
Well, we made a couple of key trades, and we got the funk.
Oh, well, glory be, the funk's on me, Bobby.
Keep that funk alive.
Well, it's 1975, and we'll just be keeping the funk alive.
The Ray Guns only exist in the fictional universe of Nike commercials. Nike, an NBA marketing partner and preeminent arbiter of sports marketing fashion, created the spots as an homage to the funky, freestyle play of the old American Basketball Association, which was folded into the NBA in 1976. The spots fuse the music of funk masters George Clinton and Bootsy Collins with images of current NBA players transported back into the days of big hats, hot pants, and slam dunking with a red, white, and blue ball.
Man, the ABA was the funk league.
Jimmy Smith of the ad firm Wieden & Kennedy wrote the Dr. Funk commercials. Why let the funk out the trunk now?
You know why? The reason is that was the last era where it was just the coolest. If you just look at hip-hop culture, those cats don't sample from the 80s. They don't sample from the 90s. They go back to the 70s. Everything was real then.
Many traditional fans still have a problem with the state of the game since the tattooed heirs of the ABA took control of the sport. You might expect to find them at a place like the Black Duck, a bar in affluent Westport, Connecticut that had 6 TV screens going during the playoffs. Manager Mike Connors has mixed feelings about the young star's stewardship of the league.
You're going in between, you know, the old-time basketball to the new-time basketball. What kind of, what they're trying to prove, I don't understand. You know what? I don't think everybody needs all that ink on their body and all that stuff, but it's a different time, you know, and we're all got to sit there and, you know, look at it. But if I had my own way, I'd be back the old-time way.
As Laker guard Kobe Bryant vaults over 7-foot net center Todd McCullough and slams the ball home, Lenny Zook exults. He flushed it.
Well, to see something like that is, to me, it's a sign of sheer emotion. It has nothing to do with the dunk. It has to do with emotion. And I love to see passion come out in any sport.
For Zook, keeping that funk alive means respecting the evolution of the game.
Basketball started out as a sport that was meant as an exercise. As soon as it got into the urban culture, it took on a life of its own. And that's really where basketball was born, was more out of the urban culture because they were able to make it their own, personalize it, and be able to make it more of an art form.
Zook is older than the Nike commercial's target audience. Credit David Stern for the fact that he still gets it. When he took over the league in 1982, Stern took what was perceived as the league's liabilities, too black, too improvisational, too funky, and turned them into assets. He legitimized the slam dunk by giving it a showcase at the annual All-Star Game and brought the ABA three-point shot into the NBA. And as for the grumbling from older fans that sounded like fear of an all-black league, Stern simply ignored it.
Because the very kids of those fans who grew up with Dr. J were totally focused on a combination of skill and fashion and not on race. We've had it come back again in some ways, you know, when we went from Afro to cornrow.
And my reaction to that was the same. Hey, it's about fashion.
It's proved to be a smart strategy, according to Bob Williams, president of Burns Sports, an Evanston, Illinois firm that advises big corporations on using athletes to build their brands.
Unlike its predecessors who were once under 40, this under 40 group is far more difficult to maintain as a loyal NBA-watching fan.
Besides Nike, this year's funky hip-hop-inflected commercials depict NBA players doing their thing for brands including Burger King, Nestle, Sprite, Reebok, and Gatorade. Even George Gervin, once a funkily prolific scorer from the ABA glory days, now sells business solutions for IBM. Funk sells because it's about the essence of having a unique style of expression. That's why it works to reach a generation that seems to prize individuality above all things, even race.
There's no homogeneous society now, and you say, well, the society at large won't accept this.
Washington Post sports columnist Michael Wilbon.
It doesn't work that way. It's far too fragmented. There are far too many people with various tastes, whether they're musical, whether they pertain to sports or business or entertainment. And so I don't think that's bad. I just think it's something that we have to recognize, and we have to stop looking at situations where we expect one person to be all there is. I think we've seen sort of the end of that craze. I don't know that Michael Jordan wasn't the final situation where we can look to one corporate pitch man and say, this guy can get it done on every level. We may not see that again.
Can I say one more thing?
Jimmy Smith of Wieden & Kennedy has four words for all those who aren't feeling the full expression of the old ABA DNA in the NBA.
Get over it, man. That's another reason why we went back to the ABA instead of, you know, reminiscing on the NBA. The ABA was that rebel league that people loved to hate. They didn't like the big afros. They didn't like the goatees. It's the same thing now with the cornrows, with the tattoos. A few years down, we'll be looking at that and we'll be going, man, wasn't it great back then in the late 90s? And those players, Vince Carter, jumped over a man. Dunked on. It was the bomb. It was great.
And when that day comes, we might see Allen Iverson, tattoos, cornrows, attitude and all, selling business solutions for IBM. For On the Media, I'm Leon Winter. Stop the beat. Cut.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, and engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe. We had help from Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Thanks to the Culture Desk at WGBH and the public radio website transom.org.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Mike Pesca.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.